Blog Talk Radio. It's breaking news on the Eastern Airlines radio show. Dorothy.
You turn Dorothy on?
Well, Dorothy, it just dropped off. I'm going to tell you the breaking news about the anniversary of the EAA 1929 Ford Trimotor made history. In 1923, Colonial Airlines was the first conceived when a charter service known as the B-Line came into being at Naugatuck, Connecticut. On November 10th, 2017, it marks the 92nd anniversary of Ford unveiling the trimotor airplane. On November 10th, 1925, Colonial Airlines in 1925 established a scheduled service between Boston and New York, acquiring the first domestic airmail contract when the Post Office Department transferred airmail service to private operations under the Kelly Act of 1925. One of Eastern's Ford trimotors is still flying. It belongs to the EAA today, and they flew the EAA 1929 Ford trimotor on their visit to the Miami Executive Airport back 8 months ago. See more of the article and newsletter dated August, December 17.
World Airways wants to use 787s for discount flights to Asia and Latin America. But old names on new carriers have a bad track record. Nostalgia runs deep in the U.S. airline business. Witness attempts at resurrections over the years of Braniff, Pan American, Eastern, and People Express. The newest effort in the everything that's old is new again business is a low-cost venture that aims to fly Boeing Company's 787s to Asia and South America, replicating the type of long-haul operation that Norwegian Air has sought to pioneer with the 787 in Europe. An investment firm, 777 Partners, said Wednesday it acquired rights to fly as World Airways, a carrier that took to the skies after World War II as the armed forces' dominant troop transport service. World, which was based in suburban Atlanta, shut down in 2014 after the U.S. Air Force canceled a key contract and creditors withdrew funding. Now it's coming back. See more of the article and newsletter online August, December 17.
Breaking news number three. 747 flies final U.S. passengers by Mary Grady. Boeing 747, the iconic hump two-deck jet, flew its last flight over United Airlines on Tuesday. The four-engine wide-body had lost ground to more efficient modern aircraft. The United Airlines crew flew the final trip from San Francisco to Honolulu, tracing some routes as the first United 747 did in 1970. From a 1970-inspired menu, to retro uniforms for flight attendants to in-flight entertainment befitting of that first flight. Passengers will help send the Queen of the Skies off in true style. That's what United said in a news release. You can see more of this article and newsletter online August through December 2017. Chuck.
Breaking news number 4. Uber signed with NASA to develop an air taxi route, byline Paul Bernelli. Uber signed a deal with NASA to develop software for the air taxi it plans to have in service within 5 years. At a web conference in Lisbon on Wednesday, Uber's Jeff Holden said, the company is teaming with NASA to develop a range of technologies designed to track and deconflict its human carrier quadcopter from others and from other manned aircraft. Earlier this year, Uber announced plans to develop on-demand air taxi system that will initially be tested in Dallas, followed by Los Angeles in 2020. The company says it hopes to launch Uber Air before 2028 Olympics in Los Angeles. See more of the article and newsletter online August, December 17.
Hello, Eastern family. It's great having you with us for our 341st broadcast tonight. Before we go into our show, I want to remember 2 days ago was Veterans Day. Our Veterans Day program was delivered this past Monday and a week ago, and we just wanted to have a reminder of all the veterans that served in all the wars living and those that have passed away. And so to begin our show, want to play a Pledge of Allegiance that was videoed by a young high school student. And this is the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. You wear patriotic clothes. Do you know why? You place your hand over your heart. Do you know why? He leaves his family for you. He misses his mom for you. She fights for you. He stands up for what is right for you. She protects us from harm for you. I pledge because it honors my dad. Why do you pledge? Please stand and honor our troops as we sing our national anthem.
Together, folks. You can't separate them. We want to welcome and thank all of our listeners who called into our broadcast to listen. We would love to hear your comments or have you share your memories by saying hello or hi to talk with us on the air. Our thanks also to those who choose to listen by computer using the radio icon on our homepage, www.ealradioshow.com, or perhaps using the computer and you sign in at the site Blog Talk Radio, and that's .com/ Captain Eddie, CAPTEDDIE. Should you wish to be live or talk during the live broadcast, feel free to use our call-in number, 213-816-1611, at, of course, 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Our lines are open for calls, and if you choose not to participate and talk, we ask you please to mute your phone, as our producer's board does not have the capability of filtering out background noises. Now let's get episode 341 in the air.
Make and model. Most of us could tell you the name, make, and model of cars while we were growing up. We could tell by the grille, the emblem on the hood, taillights, and other prominent features. The names were easy, the models not so. The names were usually always associated with the founders of these cars. There was Henry Ford, of course, Walter Chrysler, David Dunbar Buick, Louis Chevrolet, John and Horace Dodge, Antoine Lumet de la Motte, Sue de Cadillac, Ransom E. Olds, Peter Studebaker, Joseph L. Hudson, James and William Packard, and the great Indian chief, Pontiac. Two popular European autos also were named after the founder, and in one case, daughter of the founder, Emil Jelinek and Carl Benz car, named after Jelinek's daughter, Mercedes Jelinek, and a very expensive luxury automobile, Rolls-Royce founders, Henry Royce and Charles Rolls. Even motorcycles carried the founders' names, William S. Harley and childhood friend, Arthur Davidson. Chuck?
We knew the names of these makes, but it took a little more knowledge to learn the various models. For each of these auto brands, for example, Ford had a Model T, a Fairlane, a GT, a Mustang, a Taurus, just to name only a few. Buick had the Super, Roadmaster, LeSabre, the Riviera, the Century, and Skylark. Cadillac had its Fleetwood, Eldorado, Arc Avenue, and DeVille. Hudson had its Hornet, Studebaker had its Hawk series, a Flight Hawk, a Power Hawk, a Golden Hawk, and it developed an all stainless steel car called the Avanti. Helicopters were represented by Sikorsky's R-4, world's first production helicopter. Igor Sikorsky also built the S-42 Pan American Clipper, the flying boats. Bell helicopter was by Dale Bell, and of course Howard Hughes copter were by Howard Hughes. Oh, we forgot to mention another automobile, the Rickenbacker, founded by our own hero, Captain Eddie Rickenbacker. Did you know that there were over 35,000 cars built that carried the captain's name? Ken?
Hey, wait a minute. I thought this was a show that had to do about aircraft and things like that, not necessarily the automobiles. Well, you know what? Maybe we should go on ahead and talk about that a little bit. You know, just giving you a little background for the fixed wings and their founders, the makes and models and such. Now, the general aviation aircraft we'll mention are Piper, with models J3 Cub, Tri-Pacer, Cherokee, Navajo, Chieftain, and others. Now, William T. Piper was the founder of this popular general aviation aircraft. The founder for Cessna was Clyde Cessna back in 1911. Some of the Cessna models are the Cessna C-120, 140, 150, C-170, 180, C-182, C-310, and the C-401 series, and, of course, the CE-500 Citation Jet and more. Walt Beach and his wife, Olive Ann Beach, were the founders of Beechcraft Aircraft in Wichita, Kansas, back in 1932, and had the very popular modern series Bonanza, that I call a banana, the Debonair, the DA Twin, Twin Beach, King Air Beach 1900, or again, Beachliner, got a little time in that, and the 2000 series, and of course, the Beach Jet, just to name a few. Stinson, Eddie Stinson, actually built several single-engine aircraft, the Stinson Detroiter, the Stinson 105 Voyager, and the very popular 108 Stinson. The company also built, all the way back into the early 1930s for airlines that operated that Stinson trimotor, SM-6000, which seat at one time 10 passengers. Now, only the two of the high-wing models, I believe, are known to exist. One is owned by Greg Herrick in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and the other by Kermit Weeks, and is maintained in an airworthy condition at the Fantasy of Flight in Polk County City, Florida, actually, which is quite near our host, Linda Fuller. Now, Fairchild was founded by Sherman Fairchild back in 1924, based in Farmingdale, New York, the birthplace of my wife. The company built the single-engine general aviation aircraft as well as the training for military pilots during the war. Now, a famous U.S. Air Force troop carrier C-19 boxcar, probably not the sexiest thing to go through the air, but they built it. They built the Fairchild F. Dornier jet 1991 in the C-26 Metroliner, otherwise known as the Smoky Stagpipe on its built, the Death Tube, or the Pencil with Wings. Got a little time in that, too. Ford, the automobile giant, built the Ford Trimotor as well as the Tin Goose. Everybody's heard of that, haven't we? Henry Ford, also along with his son, Edsel, and the other investors, built a total of 199 of these three-engine radio-engine aircraft that would seat anywhere but 8 or 9 passengers and crew of 3, pilot, co-pilot, and stewardess. Maybe I should have said flight attendant, but I like stewardess better. How about you guys? Now, this number increased from 15 to 17 passengers in later models. There was about 18 in existence, one of which is the Eastern Airport Inc. in colors. Bill?
Now let's talk about large transport category aircraft.
Yeah.
Douglas Aircraft was founded by none other than Donald Wills Douglas Sr. back in 1921 and later merged with McDonnell Aircraft in 1967 to form McDonnell Douglas. Some of the more popular aircraft we easily can identify with are the DC-1, 2, 3, and 4, DC-5, only 5 were built in 1940, the DC-6, DC-7, DC-8, 9, and the DC-10 MD series. Douglas military aircraft served in World War II and the Korean War. In March 1910, William E. Boeing bought Heath Shipyard in Seattle on the Duwamish River, which later became his first airplane factory. Boeing was incorporated in Seattle by William Boeing on July 15, 1916, as Pacific Aero Products Company. Boeing was later incorporated in Delaware. The original certificate of incorporation was filed with the Secretary of State of Delaware on July 19, 1934. Boeing, who studied at Yale University, worked initially in the timber industry where he became wealthy and learned about wooden structures. This knowledge proved invaluable in his subsequent design and assembly of airplanes. The company stayed in Seattle to take advantage of the local supply of spruce wood. We'll only talk about the commercial aircraft operated over the years by various airlines. Here are just a few Boeing-manufactured aircraft, many of which served Eastern Airlines over the years. The 707, 720, 717, 727, 737, the iconic Boeing 747, the 757, 67, 77, the Dreamliner, Boeing 787, the 797, and the BXXX, which I am calling the B807.
There's classic 747, the smaller 737, and more recently the fancy 787 Dreamliner. And don't forget the 757, 67, and 77. So, you ever wonder, what's that, all those number sevens? What are they about? When it comes to Boeing's aircraft models, is there a method to their numbering madness? Well, it turns out, yes. According to Boeing, this is actually one of the most common questions they're asked on a day-to-day basis. Despite what you have heard or suspected, it's not because it had the affirmity for the lucky number seven. Another common myth is that they drew the name from the angle of the aircraft wings. RoadWarriorsVoice.com reported that. But the truth actually lies in what could have been one of the greatest marketing suggestions of all time. Boeing didn't have always used the 77 numbers. In fact, its earlier aircraft had names like Model 40, Model 80, Model 247, not exactly what you would call catchy titles. After World War II, the company was restructured and each department was given a three-digit number. That's when things got interesting. Boeing's historian Michael Lombard said, to support the diversification strategy, the engineering department divided the model numbers into blocks of 100 for each of the new product areas. 300, 400 continue to represent aircraft. 500 would be the turbine engine, 600 for rockets and missiles, and 700s were set aside for jet transport aircraft. Realizing the model 700 didn't exactly roll off the tongue, Boeing's marketing department suggested we name 707 instead, and the pattern began, 727, 737, and so forth. It continues to this day with the latest Boeing 787 Dreamliner model. And so you have it. Don?
Let's talk about Lockheed. The Aldo Hydro Airplane Company was established in San Francisco in 1912 by the brothers Alan and Malcolm Loghead. This is pronounced Loghead. In 1916, the company was renamed the Loghead Aircraft Manufacturing Company and relocated to Santa Barbara, California. The same year, Santa Barbara native Jack Northrop, age 20, took his first job in aviation, working as a draftsman for Loghead Aircraft. The company proceeded to design and construct the model F-1 flying boat, which debuted on March 29, 1918, to set the American nonstop record for seaplane flight by flying from Santa Barbara to San Diego, California. In 1926, Alan Loghead and Jack Northrop and Ken Jay secured funding to form the Lockheed Aircraft Company in Hollywood. The spelling was changed phonetically to prevent mispronunciation. In March 1928, the company relocated to Burbank, California, and by the year's end reported sales exceeding $1 million. From 1926 to 1928, the company produced over 80 aircraft and employed more than 300 workers, who by April 1929 were building 5 aircraft per week. In July 1929, major shareholder Fred Keeler sold 87% of Lockheed Aircraft Company to Detroit Aircraft Company. In August 1929, Alan Lockheed resigned. If you have ever wondered about the name given by Lockheed to most of the aircraft it has built, you may have noticed most use a celestial designation, hence Electra, Viagra, Orion, Constellation, Hercules, Starliner, TriStar, Saturn, and so forth. Popular airlines of Eastern and other carriers were Lockheed Constellation, and it goes from L-49, L-149, 649, 749, 849, 949, 1049, and the Super G L-1149. Proposal to use Allison turbine engines and L-1249 1249, similar to the L-1149, and the L-1649 Starliner, the L-188 Electra, and L-1011 TriStar. I goofed that all up.
Glenn L. Martin Company was founded by aviation pioneer Glenn Luther Martin on August 16, 1912. Martin started out building military trainers in Santa Ana, California, and then in 1916, Martin accepted a merger offer from the Wright Company, creating the Wright Martin Aircraft Company in September. This new company did not go well, and Glenn Martin left it to form a second Glenn L. Martin Company on September 10, 1917. This time, it was based in Cleveland, Ohio. Later, its headquarters would be moved to Baltimore, Maryland. In 1995, Martin Marietta, then the nation's third largest defense contractor, merged with the Lockheed Corporation, then the nation's second largest defense contractor, to form the Lockheed Martin Corporation, becoming the largest such company in the world. Among the famous aircraft from Martin was the B-29 Super Fortress, the M-202, M-303, and the M-404.
Ken, would you take Jim Hart's part there about Pitcairn?
Oh, I sure can. Sorry, I had it on speaker here, so let me get that off. Okay.
You're coming in loud and clear.
Oh, am I? So you can hear me just fine then? Okay, gotcha.
Oh, yeah,
thank you.
Just fine.
Yeah, gotcha. Thanks, guys. Yeah, and of course, yeah, where would you know, Eastern be without the Pitcairn Aircraft Corporation? Now, Harold Frederick Pitcairn, he'd born June 20th, 1897, and lived till April 24th of 60, was an American aviation inventor and pioneer. He played a key role in the development of the autogyro and founded the Autogyro Company of America. Now, he patented a number of innovations relating to rotary wing aircraft. Pitcairn's start in aviation was as an apprentice at the Curtiss Aeroplane and Motor Company. And he attended the Curtiss Flying School in Newport News, 1916, many years ago. And Pitcairn founded Pitcairn Aviation, later to become Eastern Airlines, and Pitcairn Aircraft Company, which manufactured quite efficient airmail via biplanes and autogyros. He bought the right to license Juan de la Cervantes patents for the United States for $300,000 in 1929. And forgive me, I may not have had that pronunciation quite there, but I gave it my best shot. Now, he was awarded the Collier Trophy in 1930 for development of the autogyro. USA President Hoover awarded the trophy on the lawn of the White House in 1931, where a Pitcairn PCA-2 landed as the first aircraft ever. On April 24th of 1960, he committed suicide at his home in Philadelphia shortly after a party celebrating his brother's birthday. Very sad. He'll be greatly missed.
Oh.
Now, Eastern was born from the most successful aircraft of that period, the Pitcairn, the PA-5 mail wing, which has been a favorite among visitors to the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum, and she is proudly displayed in what appears to be in flight. So, Dorothy, do you have any further announcements or anything else, members, emails, or future shows?
Yes, I do. But first, let me just say that some of these aircraft that have been mentioned, we have a lot of aircraft on the website that you can go in and look under the EAL history under aircraft, and you'll see a lot of these Pitcairn and some of the older models there to be shown. So take a look at them. They're really a lot, and they're great to look at. But we also have three new members I'd like to mention tonight. The first member joined us November 8th, Paul Namath, and he's age 71. His work number was 958, in case anybody remembers that. He worked in Miami 1965 to 1989, and he resides in the Blue Ridge Mountains in Georgia. John Kaiser, another member, joined November 10th, and he's 54 years old from Reading, Pennsylvania. He had an interesting story on an Eastern airplane, so I invited him to check out our website, and he did. J- John shared a memory as one of the EAL aircraft in another helicopter flying back in 84 and 86 when he worked for United Airlines and was in Gravelly Park at DCA plane spotting. He saw the almost accident between an EA-727 and a helicopter. Check out that story in From the Past on our website. There's more to it. Bill Rambo is another new member, joined November 12th, and he's 70 years old, and he worked at Eastern from January through September of 1971. He worked at JFK, Miami, San Juan, and Chicago, flew as a CSO Sky Marshal on the EAL leased B-747s out of JFK in 1971. He says, I am the author of two novels, and he's presently writing the final book in the trilogy. It centers around a former soldier who becomes a CSO and his partners on those whisper whales and a skyjacking that thankfully never happened. I would be interested in hearing from and picking the brains of any cabin crew members who worked those flights from JFK to Miami, San Juan, and ORD. I need some help on these technical details only you angels of the sky would know. So if anyone has any information on that, would be happy to have you write to hosts at eaLradio.com. Send it to us, and we'll be sure to pass it along to Bill. Now, I'd like to mention some of the upcoming episodes that we have. We have a great selection coming up. And next week, of course, we have the D.B. Cooper Unsolved Mystery, Hijacking of Northwest Flight 305. Following that, November 27th, we have Eastern's Love of the Lockheed L-1011 TriStar. Such a beautiful plane. And then following that is going to be remembering December 7th, a date which will live in infamy, which we'll all remember and never forget. And then following that in December, we have Eastern and Air Force One. So we have quite a few, and one more that we have in December before we have the Christmas holiday is those crazy airport identifiers. So we're looking forward to all of you joining us then, and please take a look at the website. We have a lot of things in From the Past that you might want to look in, see some of the memories that have been shared over the last several months, and you probably haven't got a chance to look at in them. We have a tab that we have on humor, which we have quite a few things in there that probably you haven't had a chance to go in and take a look at, and that's under more. And, of course, don't forget our book reviews and all the authors that we have. And I hope soon to have that new member join us. That would be great if we had Bill Rambo join us. So back to you, Neil.
Well, we also were notified that the Silver Liners have started a new chapter. Dorothy, let's see. Barbara Bucata, I don't know whether Barbara's with us. I've got so many phone Eric codes on my board now. Let's see. Barbara, are you with us tonight? No, apparently not. But she's telling us in an email that they have started a chapter. Dorothy, do you know anything further about that chapter up in Boston?
Yes, I do. The EAL Silver Liners were excited to announce the relaunch of the Boston chapter of the Silver Liners. A charter was presented, and they have left the gate, and congratulations to all of you. We're so happy to have another Silver Liner chapter. That's great. Back to you.
Okay.
Neil.
Okay. Very good. Now, any discussion about cars or airplanes that we had our show on tonight, and just a little background information about the airplanes that Eastern flew? Of course, there were many. We didn't name all of the aircraft that Eastern flew or the manufacturers, but anyone remember something or some aircraft that we should talk about or did we leave out tonight? I know we talked about the Electra. We talked about the Douglas aircraft. We did fly a number of Douglas airplanes, the DC-8, and we didn't fly any of the – I don't think we flew any of the MD-80 or MD aircraft, McDonnell Douglas. It was all Douglas Aircraft Corporation aircraft that we flew. Any any discussion about the airplanes that Eastern flew? We do have some upcoming. Yeah, go ahead, Bill.
Well, I think one of the things we didn't focus on tonight was Airbus Industries and, of course, the introduction as the first carrier in North America with the A300.
Absolutely, Bill. I didn't mention the I was trying to keep it with the aircraft manufacturers of America, but Airbus, yes, and I was always told, and I flew the A300 when we first got them from Airbus, and I was always told that 60% of that airplane was built by American manufacturers, the parts on that airplane. Perhaps, Chuck, you might know some information about that.
You're right. When we got the airplane, nobody wanted it, obviously, because it was so new and it was very innovative. What they did was they looked like a big Lego thing. They took parts from other airplanes and put them together and designed an airplane. And like you said, about 60 or 70% of the parts were made here in the United States. Of course, there was other companies around the world, other countries involved too, that contributed to designing the airplane. I remember one time they told me to go fix the aft cargo door. The seal was leaking, and they were losing pressurization. And I got back there, and about 2 foot of it had been blown out. So when I went to the stock room to get the seal, the seal was made by the Kawasaki Motorcycle Company. And I asked my lead man, is this somebody's joke or something? He says, no, the whole door is made by Kawasaki. He said, so is the inboard flap. It's made by Kawasaki. And after a while, after you worked on it, you realized that the different parts of the airplanes, the landing gears were made by a different company. But they were all put together in a place called Toulouse, France. And actually, I think they're still made today. They're made in Toulouse. And nobody thought that this was going to be the kind of airplane that they wanted to invest money in. But it went along, and now it's probably one of the premier airplanes that's flying today.
You know, when we first got the Airbus, I believe that was under Borman, who was the president at the time, and Charlie Simons was the person that actually negotiated and did such a financial deal with Airbus Industries that made it worthwhile Eastern ordering. And I believe we had 30 of those aircraft. Does anyone recall the exact number? Bill, do you remember?
I think the initial plan that Charlie Simons was involved in called for us to fly a smaller number for winter season to see if they would provide the fuel savings that they advertised. And from a marketing standpoint, I can tell you that there were a number of people who were very concerned about the word bus being the A300. And that's that mock-up that Chuck's talking about, that schematic drawing that showed all of those parts made in the United States, was so important. It was kind of a counter to this theory that this was just a bus in the sky.
The first one we had, by the way, was in back of the maintenance hangars on 36th Street. The old hangars that they had back in the 40s and 50s, with the big Eastern, red Eastern sign on top of it. And that plane sat there for almost 6 months before I guess Eastern decided that they were going to buy it. But they would let it, all the mechanics went through it just to see what it was like. And we saw people going in and out of the airplane all the time. But it just sat back there. They never cranked the engines up that I knew of. And finally, they decided to buy the airplane, in bulk, and they taxied the plane out one day and brought it out on the other side, out on the airfield side. But you're right, they were very apprehensive about the airplane.
Very interesting. I know we had to actually, we wanted to use the airplane in LaGuardia, and you remember what we had to do. They had to reinforce the runway there that extended out over the water, and they also positioned lead lights that when you taxied it out, you knew you would be over the support area that had been beefed up, and you would be able to go on to that end of the runway so you can depart. So that was very interesting when we first got the Airbus. Any other stories about Eastern aircraft you can think of?
I wanted to mention, Neil, that the Eastern Air Transport, I just put a small article in the underneath Eastern on that plane, and I have a video that's in the videos for people to go and look through. It's a very interesting video on that aircraft that was down in the Miami airport. So please take a look at that. It's a good little article and a video.
Okay.
You know, I just got to ask something real quick, maybe not so much related to a little bit to the aircraft. Anybody this frequency, anybody ever here on this call tonight ever fly via a lighted airway?
No,
lighted?
I'm afraid we're old, Ken, but we're not that old.
Okay, now I remember. I'm not talking about when I, you know, back in the late '80s when you know you guys were probably retired. I was learning how to fly at Sarasota here. Granted, I was in my 20s, and you guys probably remember this back in that Pitcairn mail wing. Apparently, they had these huge bonfires, right? And you took off and you headed. What you did is you headed for the next bonfire, or at least you hope you found it before the one behind you went away. Because then you were screwed. The only good news was there was no towers or power lines to run into, right? And then how they lighted these runway strips with fires, I guess, or whatever. But now I remember, and then you guys probably are familiar with this, something else I don't know. What is the name of that thing that you guys used to use that went in and out, left and right, that you listened to home in on the beacon?
Oh, you're talking about the low frequency, the range approaches, low frequency range approaches.
RDF?
Yes, RDF, thank you.
No.
Okay, there you go, that's right.
Yeah, radio direction finders.
Yes, now the lighted airways came about as a VFR, is a VFR sectional chart that I did have an Eastern pilot that had one. His name was Dave Whitman. Anybody remember Dave Whitman?
No, the name is familiar, but I didn't know him.
Okay, Eastern. He was on the Boeing 727 training department down there in Miami for a while, but he was left and was an examiner. He was my CFI examiner here in Venice, which is where Muhammad Atta, he signed off Muhammad Atta, not knowing, obviously, at the time, the World Trade Center deal. So, yeah, at the International Flying Academy there, but he had a VFR chart with lighted airways. So I didn't know if you guys ever used that. Were they common? Did they use lighted airways charts back in the 40s?
You know, yeah, they did back in the 40s. They were using range approaches, and it was based on an A and N signal, low frequency signal, dot dash for the A and dash dot for the N signal.
So, did you look at something, Neil, when you were listening to that? Did you look at a gauge, or you just listened?
No, you listened. I got my link trainer's operator license back in 1960. And I had to demonstrate a range approach to the person that was in the C3 trainer that I used to get my link trainer's license from the FAA, actually certificate from the FAA. And we had a table, and it had a recording device, and it monitored the path of the simulator, or we call them a trainer. They didn't call them duplicators or simulators, of course. They were link trainers.
Link
aircraft. I forgot his first name, was the originator of that trainer. I think he was the first one that actually got into the simulator, which eventually became the simulators. But it was interesting that the pilot could locate it. As a matter of fact, the range approaches were printed on the sectional charts, and they had four legs. And if it was an approach, the one of the legs went to the runway, and the leg opposite the station. But you could listen when the A and the N blended together. You got an on-course signal, a steady hum. And if you drifted off to the left or the right, you would get an A or an N, depending upon whether you drifted left or right. And so it was very interesting how these pilots back in the day, in the 40s and the 30s, actually did their navigation. And then they had to do the timing from over the range itself, because the range itself was situated, 5 miles, it could be more or less. But they had to time their descent feet per minute and then time it so that at a certain point in time, they should be able to see the runway at a certain height. And back in the early days, it was 200.5 was a standard Category 1 approach. I think it still is.
It is. Now, did they go to ADF or RMI after that, Neil?
Well, no, the ADF was a non-directional type of an approach. Yeah, and
it was non-precision. But, so did they come in with a
non-precision
localizer?
Right. Yeah. And then the localizer, the back course localizer, was non-precision too. And so these were, but you know, when we talk about these, I remember back in the day, we had to demonstrate for our rating, for our airline transport pilot's rating certificate, we had to demonstrate
ATR.
To the FAA, right, it was originally called the ATR, Airline Transport Rating.
Yep. Right.
And we had to actually demonstrate. I remember on my check ride, I had to do what they call a canyon approach, simulating that you came to the fix and you were in a canyon and the airport was down at a certain altitude and you had to descend as rapidly as possible to the next fix and then arrive over that fix at a certain altitude where you could see the airport. And after a while, they just said, well, no, I think we had some accidents or there were some accidents related to that. But that was probably the most difficult maneuver that most pilots had to demonstrate back when they had.
I think La Paz is like that, right?
They might still be that way. I'm not sure.
Yep. Well, that's great. Well, thanks for the info. I know it wasn't aircraft related, but I just had to ask about the cockpit. But thanks, Neil.
Oh,
yes,
okay,
Ken.
Anytime.
Ken,
yes.
You had sent me, and it's on the website, the Ford 4AT tri-motor, the Tin Goose that you mentioned tonight in one of the readings that you had. That also is that photo is on the website under From the Past, along with that vintage Eastern Airline ticket. So, folks, take a look at From the Past. We do have a lot of stuff there, and the pictures show the Ford 4 AT Tri-Motor MD-1 Tin Goose and the Ford 5 ATB McMinnville. Both of those photos Ken sent in to us to post on our website.
Yes.
Back to you.
You know, it was so interesting that we have come so far. I mean, it's just amazing when I first checked out in the 757 that I could actually see the airport. I could see my approach. I could see the airways. I could see the VORs. I could see everything on the screen. But pilots, when they first started flying, especially the male pilots, the air mail pilots that were flying, back when you mentioned the colored or the lighted airway system, the markers, and they had to navigate that way. And then when the weather got down marginal, we had some folks that were landing in fields, in cow pastures and so forth. And, of course, every once in a while they have an accident and they had to get the mail there so they would get to the nearest phone and call the company take care of that. Very interesting. And then we came to the low frequency. And then from there, we went to the VOR, the omni-range approaches. And so it's been very interesting, the progress of navigation that we use. Wonder what the next stage is going to be.
Yeah, well, with this GPS thing, I remember flying with Dave Whitman, and the kids would get, for their check ride, they would get out their handheld device. This was back in the 90s, and he would make them put it away because they couldn't read a VFR chart and look outside and say, oh, there's a water. Like, kids can't read an analog watch today. They have to look at a digital watch. So you're right. We're coming very dependent on, I don't know, I guess it's just GPS. I don't know what's beyond that. I know my dad used Loran a lot on the 7-2 in South America for La Paz and those Ascension for those airports. But it's all GPS today, I guess. But you're right. I don't know what's next.
Well, unmanned. Unmanned.
Unmanned. There you go. Yeah.
Oh, dear.
You guys haven't watched the Jetsons, have you?
Hey, George Jetsons? Oh, yeah. I watched it a lot. I'm younger. Sorry. I'll admit it. Hey, can
about
you name
another,
the characters? Yeah.
Another 50 years, that's what's going to be flying around.
Yeah, most people can't name the dog. Can anybody name the dog?
No.
I didn't watch it enough to remember that.
Astro.
Astro,
yeah.
Okay. You know, I thought another interesting thing tonight's show, we talked about Lockheed and its use of celestial bodies naming their airplanes. And,
like Viagra?
Yeah.
Yeah, that should have been
I know
Vega,
what was on your mind.
We know what you're thinking about.
Hey, wait a minute. I was the last one pushing pills here for old people. I had Viagra on the cart. Let's talk about that.
Oh, golly.
I'll tell you guys something.
In the
first 707 that I was checked out in Pan Am, they had a window in the top of the cockpit. Do you know what it's for?
What? Celestial, probably, navigation.
That's right. They had a sextant. The navigator had a sextant. He, the stars, that little window.
Okay. Yeah, they did that in World War II. They did a lot of celestial navigation.
Right.
And... you know, I'm sitting here looking at... Go ahead, Dorothy. It's your time.
I was surprised at the name Lockheed aircraft being changed from Loghead. I didn't realize that Lockheed was Alan Loghead. That was interesting information tonight as well.
Yeah.
Wow.
We've got a caller from Canada. Who might that be? I think area code 631 is. I think area code 631 is Canadian. Area code
631. That's Ottawa.
That's Ottawa, Canada. Okay.
Yeah. This is Renee. I'm 519.
Oh, you're what?
I'm 519.
519. Where's that?
Well, that's sort of in London, Ontario, but I used to be YYZ.
Okay, YYZ. Oh, absolutely. used to fly in there lots of times.
Yeah, you guys said a lot. Old Terminal 1.
Yeah. When did you fly? What's your name again? I forgot.
Renee McKinnon.
Renee. Okay, this is Renee. All right. I think I've asked you this question before, Renee. Were you there when we had the 1011 that they fuel and we dipsticked it? Or you guys at the station there in Toronto dipsticked it and the plug came out and all the fuel was running all over the ramp?
That was you, was it?
That was me. On the old 1011. Yeah.
Yeah, we had a lot of these with a 1011 there.
They
so
tried and tried.
Hey? Say what?
Where in Canada are you?
Oh, I'm in London, Ontario. That's 2 hours east of the Toronto right now.
Oh.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll never forget that incident. I think it was about a 2 hour delay. And finally, one of the ramp service guys decided that, well, I'm going to get wet. I'm going to take a shower, a JP shower, fuel, jet fuel. And he put on the rain gear and everything else, and he got the conveyor, mobile conveyor that put the luggage on the 1011, you know, back the freight. And he stood up on that, and he took the plug that had gone to the ground, of course, and he picked it up and stuck his hand up there. And man, I mean, fuel was running all over him.
Wow.
And it was all over the ramp, and the emergency vehicles were, the fire department was out. And he finally got the threads of that plug to seat, and he finally got it to in there and shut the fuel off. But it was interesting.
Yeah. That would have been, we had a maintenance manager up there. Eastern brought him in because we were a B station. We didn't have maintenance. John was the guy that ran around and did all this sort of stuff, and he saved us many, many, many times in a situation like that.
Wow. How's the weather up there, Renee?
Well, for us, it's about 5 degrees Celsius.
Okay.
You know what that sounds like or feels
not
like?
Not very encouraging.
Yeah, right. Well, in a couple of days, we're going to be up to 10 Fahrenheit.
Let's get better.
Oh, good Lord.
Oh, God. I wouldn't lie.
Hey, Neil.
Yeah,
this is Chuck. I got a good one for you. We were talking about Walter Beach and his wife, Ann. When he was on his deathbed, he asked his wife to build an airplane, and that airplane was called a Starship, and it was named after the Enterprise on Star Trek.
Uh-huh.
You remember it went backwards. They were in the back. It was a futuristic-looking airplane, and she made the company build the airplane because nobody else wanted in the company to build it because it was so expensive. And I saw on our little thing here that it wasn't on our printout tonight.
Well, did anyone see the new design by NASA of future commercial aircraft on the internet?
Yes.
They have an engine, rear-mounted engine, and it's not supplied by fuel. It's generated from the electrical, I guess, connected to some kind of electrical motor or whatever at the end for that engine. And that electrical power comes from number one and number three engine out on the wings. So it's two engines on the wing and one engine mounted in the tail with no S duct for intake of air. The air actually comes from around the fuselage and goes into the inlet. And there it's turned by a turbine and produces the thrust from that engine. So it's a fuel saver from what NASA says. And Chuck, did you see that on the internet?
No, I saw it on one of the news things on the television.
Yeah,
they were
very interesting.
Talking about future generations, it was in connection with the cars, the autonomous cars that I was talking about last week.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The week before. This was brought in future things that's going to happen. But this past couple of weeks, I think it was Mercedes-Benz has come out and said they have built an autonomous car. It's at a test track. They don't touch anything. They just sit there and play the Jetsons.
Oh,
so that's
going to
be interesting.
Well, kind of a loose show tonight. But go ahead, Chuck, before I.
What I want to know
Captain
is.
Steve, then.
Who are they going to blame for the accident? Because you know one of them's coming. I can see it now. They both jump out of their cars and say, "It was your computer that did this, you know."
Yeah.
We'll have to see.
I think the insurance companies will split it 50-50.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, right now we're going to take it out of here, and we're going to let Captain Steve land this aircraft, this flight 341. And Captain Steve, it's all yours.
Well, okay. Let me. You going to play the music? Great landing, Captain Steve. Be sure to tune in again next Monday at 7 p.m. when Eastern Flight 342 will be taxiing from the gate with another adventure. We know now what happened to B. Do you know what happened to B.D. Cooper? Most of us do. That is our show for tonight, and we thank all participants in tonight's show. We thank you very much. And with this, we'll take a line from Garrison Keillor, Lake Winnebagon.
Where
are all the women unequal? All men are good looking. All children and grandchildren are above average. Until then, we say good night, Eastern family. We love you,
good
Eastern.
Good night, Eastern.
Good night, Eastern.
Good night. Good night, Eastern.